and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Marquise McLaughlin, a father of three, was shot and killed by Michael Draca in front of a convenience store in Clearwater, Florida last week. Draca was causing a disturbance, something he's been fined for in the past, and McLaughlin had gotten out of his car to confront him when Draca pulled a gun and began firing. Now the sheriff of Pinellas County has said his hands are tied because of the state's Stand Your Ground law and that he will not make an arrest. This is part one of the story. Next, we have part two of that story about Marquise McLaughlin's murder and the Stand Your Ground defense in Florida. Then ISIS fighters carried out a major suicide bombing and initiated subsequent fighting in the southern Syrian town of Soweta this morning, killing at least 150 people. Soweta is controlled by the Assad government, which only recently dislodged ISIS fighters from it. Meanwhile, Israeli forces went on alert today, and air raid sirens sounded, for fear that the fighting could approach the Golan Heights, Syrian territory occupied by Israel since 1967. And then Maria Butina, the Russian graduate student being accused of failing to register as an agent of a foreign government, appeared in court in Washington today to schedule a trial date and associated hearings. And finally, the European Union is preparing to impose $20 billion in new tariffs on American cars in response to President Trump's tariffs on European goods 2 weeks ago. The EU's trade chief said in advance of a meeting with Trump that the EU does not want a trade war, but would match U.S. tariffs dollar for dollar. Meanwhile, Trump said that he was willing to provide Midwestern farmers hit by the EU tariffs with $12 billion in cash assistance. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Florida. Marquise McLaughlin, a father of three, was shot and killed by Michael Draca in front of a convenience store in Clearwater, Florida last week. Draca was causing a disturbance, something he's been fined for in the past, and McLaughlin got out of his car to confront him when Draca pulled a gun and began firing. Now Draca is arguing that Florida's Stand Your Ground law allowed him to shoot with no consequences. Is this Trayvon Martin too? We're joined from West Palm Beach, Florida by Brad Schlesinger. He's an appellate attorney licensed to practice before the Supreme Court. And we're joined from Clearwater, Florida by Michelle Rayner. She's the attorney who is representing the family of Marquise McLaughlin. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Michelle, let's start with you. When I first saw the news reports that Draca was using the Stand Your Ground law as his defense, allowing him to just shoot a man who was actually in retreat, and there's video to show that, I thought it was a bad joke, a desperate attempt to save himself, but it appears that there's an argument here because of the way this law is written. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And also, it was the sheriff who actually said he wouldn't arrest him.
Which was outrageous. It was the sheriff who said that he wouldn't arrest him.
Go ahead.
And it's not up to the sheriff to make that decision.
So there is so many nuances with the rule, and as I'm sure some of you may be aware, and for those who aren't aware, this rule has been rewritten time and time again since about 2005 in the state of Florida. There is the most current revision to the rule that happened in 2017, where the burden now shifts to the prosecution to prove that it wasn't, in fact, not a Stand Your Ground case. So when you look at Stand Your Ground, there's a couple of things that you want to look at. First off, the statute talks about you meet force with force. You meet deadly force with deadly force. In the case of Marquise McLaughlin and Mr. Draca, you never saw Mr. McLaughlin brandish a weapon. You never saw him, you know, try to hunker down and beat him. And in fact of the matter, Mr. McLaughlin was shot in his side, which is, you know, consistent with what witnesses have said, that he went, once he pushed him to leave his, you know, family alone, that the matter was done. Secondly, there is, you know, there's a clause within the statute that, for example, that if the sheriff does arrest Mr. Draca and for some reason he's able to prevail on a Stand Your Ground defense, that can open him up to liability. However, I will say this, that I've never known that to stop this sheriff from arresting anybody with regard to that, nor have I'm really aware of any cases that he's being sued with that. However, you know, because of all these revisions and because of all these just nuances in the law, it is now, I think, it's now kind of handicapping law enforcement as well to be able to make the decision to arrest people like Mr. Draca. So it's, I mean, there is, you know, I've said this before and I'll say it again, you cannot provoke a fight and then hide behind stand your ground. That's not what that law is for. And that's essentially what Mr. Draca did.
Well, here we have a situation, Brad, and Michelle, same question to you. A white man is harassing a black man's family. That's what it appears. The black man pushes him, and the white man takes out a gun and shoots the unarmed black man and kills him. And the sheriff says almost instantly, oh, can't arrest the white man who just shot the unarmed black man and killed him in front of his children. He was in the store buying candy for his children. Can't arrest him. And you know, anybody looking at that, unless you came from Mars and had no understanding of what America looks like, you'd have to say from the beginning, on its face, this looks like a racist murder that's been tolerated by a police department in a southern state in the area of the country. Well, I don't know if we should say single out the South. Malcolm X said the South started at the U.S.-Canadian border. But anyway, it looks like racism's right out there. Go ahead, Bren.
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the biggest concerns when it comes to issues around stand your ground laws, that it puts people in more of a position to feel like they could just use deadly force whenever they feel like it, regardless of whether or not it's appropriate or not. Now, you know, these laws, these self-defense and stand your ground laws in Florida, it still requires that, you know, you act in a reasonable way and that your fear of imminent death or great bodily harm be reasonable. And I think that it's pretty easy to look at this video and come to the conclusion there's nothing reasonable about a fear of imminent death or great bodily harm. I would argue that being pushed to the ground you shouldn't put anybody in fear of death or great bodily harm to warrant such that you should shoot somebody. And, you know, that is one of the biggest factors. You know, I know there's some social science research on this issue of what role race plays when it comes to issues like stand your ground. But I think the bigger concern is that in America, there's undoubtedly a perception that black people are more dangerous. And this is an erroneous perception that is held by the vast majority of white people in this country. And so if you get, you know, the old saying, if you give an inch to take a mile, if you even give somebody the ability to even potentially think they might be able to just shoot someone if they feel threatened, if you have a law like this, it's probably going to make that individual a lot more likely to go ahead and pull that trigger than not.
I mean, and that's 100%. And just even to back that up, you know, there are, you know, I've spoken to people and witnesses have come forward that allegedly Mr. Draca, you know, he would do this all the time. And the only people that he would harass about this handicap spot, which we need to add that he wasn't entitled to, was African-American men. So there's that part of that piece to it there. And then also, you know, I spoke to another victim of Mr. Draca's in the sense that he advanced him, he was going to pull out on him, he called him all kinds of N-words and all of those things, and then proceeded to call this person's company and say, you know, you almost lost the, you know what, to, you know, today, because he parked in this handicap spot. So there is this, and I feel like America has become emboldened, especially with the administration that we have. There's some Americans that, you know, have become emboldened to feel like they can do these kinds of things. And then when you have a man that is walking around and not being arrested, well, I can, if I get mad and I just don't like the way you look or I feel that you're threatening me, I can do what I want to do. So this, if this is, you know, we're going back to this OK Corral type, you know, Old West, Wild West type situation, I mean, it's really, it becomes open season on black people.
I would argue it's even worse. I think you're right. People have been emboldened by this administration. We've never, at least not in my lifetime, have we seen people so willing to just go out and spew vile racist things in public. But I would say, too, that you know, people saw what happened in Ferguson. They saw what happened in Staten Island and in Baltimore and elsewhere around the country. And they saw what happened with Trayvon Martin and his family. And I think that a lot of people have come to the conclusion that it's okay to murder black people. That if there's even just an inkling that you might get hit or smacked or pushed or whatever, you can pull out a gun and you can murder this guy and you're going to get away with it. You're going to get away with it because there are multiple precedents for this kind of a thing.
there's an entire political party that supports their proposition that killing black people is okay and that state agents murdering black people in the street is the norm and not something to be overly concerned about. And I think when you combine this administration's sort of openness to white nationalism and hostility to black people with sort of permissive laws like Stand Your Ground and the gun culture of America, it is just a complete recipe for disaster.
100% agree. And then you, not only with the administration, that you also have Jeff Sessions that's literally taking back, you know, 100 years, anything, any progressive things that have been done with regards to race, with regards to, you know, criminal justice reform. He's like, nope, let's not do that. So you have, a quote unquote, I don't even want to call him a president, it's someone that sits in the White House that literally has, said, well, the white supremacists in Charlotte were good people. So then if I'm someone that is in alignment with those views, oh, okay, well, I have someone that is, quote unquote, the leader that says that this is okay. So why would I feel any repercussions? Why would I feel that anything would happen to me? And in fact, he's actually validating how I already feel. And so it really is becoming, and having grown up in Clearwater and having lived here, it's quite shocking, but it's not quite shocking because I have parents that were in the civil rights movement. My mother, walked with Malcolm, like she worked, with Martin, and those kinds of things. So when you have my mom saying, wow, this is reminiscent of the 1960s. Wow, this is the energy and the feeling that it is unsafe to be black, and especially unsafe to be a black male in America. It is not safe. Black men don't get the same opportunities. They don't get the same opportunities to be seen as young boys. They don't even get the same opportunities to be seen as a man. Because I guarantee you, if it was a white man that shoved him, would we be having this conversation today?
Absolutely not.
That's Michelle Rayner. She is the attorney who is representing the family of Marquise McLaughlin, black man shot dead in front of his children after he tried to buy his children or was buying candy for his children in Clearwater, Florida. Real quick, we have 30 seconds left. Michelle, I want to go back to you, even though you were the one who just spoke, because you said you grew up in Clearwater. It is Trump, and it is the Republican Party, and it is Jeff Sessions, but we had Hillary Clinton back in the day in the 1990s saying, about young black men mainly, that there was a class of black men in America who were the super predators. At the same time, the Clinton administration adopted policies that led to real, the mandatory minimums, the mass incarceration phenomena. In other words, there is this bipartisan sort of racism in America. But just because you went through all of this, do you feel that we are in a different moment now than we were, say, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago?
I definitely feel we're in a different moment. I definitely feel that, even the Clintons have, kind of come back and even, backed up on, those policies and have said, oh, wow, we were wrong. We're in a different moment because you have someone that does not care that's in the White House. And when you had, at least when the Obama administration, you had that kind of tethering of holding, local law enforcement and state law enforcement accountable with the Justice Department. I couldn't even ask the Justice Department to come in and look on this because Jeff Sessions is going to be like, good luck.
Yeah, that's the voice of Michelle Rayner. John, this is an important discussion. We're going to continue it after a short break to talk about what happened in Clearwater, what it means for Florida, what it means for the country. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We're going to continue our conversation about the killing of Marquise McLaughlin, a father of three, who was shot and killed by Michael Draca in front of his children at a convenience store in Clearwater, Florida. Michael Draca is using the state of Florida's Stand Your Ground law to defend himself. We're speaking with Brad Schlesinger. He's an appellate attorney licensed to practice before the Supreme Court, and he has tried Stand Your Ground cases. And we're joined from Clearwater, Florida by Michelle Rayner. Michelle is the attorney who is representing the family of Marquise McLaughlin. Brad, let's go back to you. Racism has always been a problem in this country, from even before the founding of the country. But as you said in the last segment, people are more emboldened now with this administration and with with killings and shootings that we've seen over the last 5, 10 years, even longer, where do you think we're going? Do you think it's going to continue to get worse, or do you think there's a way we can improve this?
It's hard to look at the current situation and see it as any other thing that things have gotten worse over the last few years. Now, maybe that is mostly responsible to the rise of this sort of populist movement on the right and the fact that, you know, the Republican Party won big at the polls and, you know, controls most of government now. I'd like to think that over the last 50 or so years that racism is on the decline. It's just there might be some more people who are a little bit more emboldened about it. I think one of the most important things, though, that is happening is that now, with the advent of technology, we can more show people what everyday racism looks like, whether it's from the police or just local interactions. And I think that's one of the biggest things that can help combat the sort of rise of this populist racist movement among, you know, people on the right. And so the more that we can let people know what's happening, show them videos, show them the raw data of what takes place in the criminal justice system. I mean, here in Florida, there's been reports recently that show that black people are sentenced at way higher rates than white people for similar crimes based on similar circumstances. I don't think people can really understand that sort of information until it's staring at you right in the face, and you can look at the numbers and see just the extraordinarily high prison sentences that black people are getting for the same crimes as white people. It's impossible to look at that and accept anything other than the fact that those outcomes are based solely on race.
Michelle, you're representing the family of McLaughlin, father of three, shot dead by this vigilante who, according to the Stand Your Ground law, says that he, and apparently the sheriff so far agrees with him, that he had the right to shoot this unarmed person. In Clearwater, what's the reaction from inside the black community among people of conscience? What's going on? What's it been like in the last days?
I mean, the last days, it's definitely been, I mean, the outpouring of support has been tremendous. I mean, I will tell you just personally, I have friends that I've grown up with, you know, good old boys, you know, gun-toting Second Amendment, you know, just good old boys. And they've called me, they've texted me, you know, Michelle, this is wrong. This is a bad shoot. This isn't right. You know, they're writing letters. And obviously the black community is outraged because, you know, we get to the point where we're asking people to stop killing us. I think we also have to look at this, and I think Brad touched on this a little bit, just even Stand Your Ground, when it's used, and there's been some studies done, and the states that have Stand Your Ground laws, that it disproportionately affects people of color and oppressed people and communities that are economically disadvantaged. So here, once again, you have Stand Your Ground. It can be used for everybody else, but yet it doesn't seem to benefit the person that needed it the most. And Mr. McLaughlin, if you really want to have the conversation, Mr. McLaughlin was the one that was really standing his ground. He was defending his family. Mr. Draca was advancing on the vehicle. He was yelling and screaming violently, according to the different witnesses that have been interviewed, been talked to. And then also, this is what he's done before. So why is it that it can benefit this man? And it's very clear that he made a conscious decision to kill Mr. McLaughlin. It took him about 4 seconds, and Mr. McLaughlin was shot in his side. So all of those things, you know, considering the totality of the circumstances, why is this man not in custody?
Yeah, and that's really, really the question. That's the voice of Michelle Rainier, the attorney who is representing the family of Marquis McLaughlin, shot down, killed in front of his own children in Clearwater, Florida. Brad Schlesinger, there's the case of Marissa Alexander, black woman, also in Florida. She was threatened by an abusive husband, had a track record of abuse. She fired a gun. I think she fired into the roof, into the ceiling of her room as a sort of a warning shot as she tried to flee him. She got something like 20 years in prison. I mean, when we think about standing your ground, I mean, the most frequent cause of violence in America is spousal abuse, by far. I mean, it's really women being attacked by men, and largely and frequently, most frequently, by people from their family. Here's a case where she felt threatened, a history of abuse. She fired a shot. I think she's out of prison now. I was going to demonstrations here in Washington, D.C., demanding her freedom because the state of Florida sentenced her to such a long prison term. And again, when I want to ask you about her case and what's going on with it and your own experience in as an attorney with Stand Your Ground.
So the Michelle Alexander case is a pretty interesting circumstance. It actually does a couple of things. It combined, you know, issue of self-defense and Stand Your Ground with Florida's 1020 life of firearm laws. Basically, we have determinant sentencing laws which punish the discharge of a firearm and the commission of a crime with a 20-year mandatory minimum. And so that was the problem for Michelle Alexander. She discharged a firearm, sort of like you mentioned, up in the air and towards the ceiling of her house in an attempt to scare off her incredibly abusive ex-boyfriend. One of the things that, you know, you didn't mention, which is important, is that Michelle Alexander is a black woman. And here's a black woman who wasn't afforded this protection of Stand Your Ground. You know, she was arrested and she was charged. Whereas here we have, you know, a white man committing a shooting and he's not being arrested or charged. And I thought it was pretty interesting that the sheriff, in his statement, said that his hands were tied and that he couldn't possibly do anything. Like you mentioned, I've represented people who have raised Stand Your Ground claims. You know, I've won Stand Your Ground hearings. My clients were always arrested, and not one of them was white. And so this is just this complete contradiction in the way that the criminal justice system works. White man shoots black person, we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt and hear what they have to say. Black person shoots anybody, they're going to get arrested. And if they have a claim, understand your ground, they're going to have to tell it to the judge or tell it to a jury, but they're surely going to get arrested and processed through the system.
100% agree, because that is literally, I'm a criminal defense attorney as well, and I'm a criminal defense attorney in Pinellas County, Florida, and I have had clients that have said, well, you know, Ms. Rainer, I was standing my ground. And guess what? We were having that conversation when they were in custody.
We have about a minute and a half left. Brad, let me ask you, are you seeing any hope of a change in this legislation? Is the legislature reacting in any way to these killings?
My biggest concern here in Florida is that the National Rifle Association owns the legislature and that it's incredibly difficult to pass any sort of reform to our gun laws. And so as long as sort of Republicans control things in this state and the NRA has such a tight grip around the legislature, it's going to take a lot of work to get things changed here.
It seems to me, Michelle, with that said, in our last 45 seconds, given that reality, it has to be people in the community, people in the streets, black people, Latino, white people, people of all races and ethnicities, coming together and saying, look, if the government's in the hands of the NRA, if the sheriffs are acting just like they did in the good old days, so-called, and always allowing white people the benefit of the doubt when they kill black people and super prosecuting black people, the only hope really seems to be in the streets, in the community. Anyway, go ahead.
No, and that's 100%. And, you know, our really right now, you know, our mantra, you know, around this is that pressure bust pipes. And we are putting the pressure on. And we do have progressive lawmakers here in Florida that have reached out saying, you know, this has got to go, because really this is so reminiscent of Trayvon Martin. You know, I've been talking with Ben Crump a lot. And this is, he's saying, Michelle, this is just so reminiscent of Trayvon Martin. Because at some point, when are we going to make that change? But I definitely agree with Brad. This is the reality that we live in Florida, when the NRA can not only control the lawmakers, but also controls the law enforcement.
Yeah, and it also controls the debate, unfortunately. We're going to have to leave it there. We are joined from West Palm Beach, Florida, by Brad Schlesinger. He's an appellate attorney licensed to practice before the Supreme Court. And we were joined from Clearwater, Florida, by Michelle Rainer. She's the attorney who is representing the family of Marquise McLaughlin. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. ISIS fighters carried out a major suicide bombing and initiated subsequent fighting in the southern Syrian town of Soweida this morning, killing at least 150 people. Soweida is controlled by the Assad government, which only recently dislodged ISIS fighters from it. Meanwhile, Israeli forces went on alert today and air raid sirens sounded for fear that the fighting could approach the Golan Heights, Syrian territory occupied by Israel since 1967. We're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Walter, help us figure this out. So Soweida has been going back and forth between jihadi rebels and the Syrian government for a couple of years now, at least. The Assad government had sent the army in just very recently. They dislodged what they thought were the last of the ISIS fighters. And then today there's this suicide terrorist bombing. What does that mean for Soweda and for the authority of the Syrian army in southwestern Syria?
Well, it definitely shows that ISIS is not a completely defeated force. I mean, certainly it's been diminished vastly from its height, where it controlled everything from, you know, all the way into central and northern Syria, across the Euphrates River, into Iraq, and basically it was the northern third of Iraq that they controlled at their height. Now they control basically isolated pockets in different parts of Syria and are able to carry out some sort of, you know, guerrilla-style attacks in Iraq. So that's sort of where ISIS is right now. But this attack is truly devastating. I mean, like you said in the opening, you know, over 100 people, you know, maybe 150 people killed, many, many more wounded, and the fact that they can carry out an attack of this type really does say something. Now, there's to add a further layer of complication to this, though, the ISIS fighters that operate in that particular part of Syria, right? So in southwest Syria, where Soweda is, where Daraa is, and this has been the focal point of the fighting in the civil war over the past month or two, that affiliate of ISIS, or that sort of those brigades that pledge loyalty to ISIS, aren't sort of like organic ISIS, if you could say it that way. There are a number of armed groups, I think three different armed groups, that in 2016 pledged allegiance to ISIS and then merged to form this formation called the Khalid ibn Walid Army. And so while it's, you know, it's loyal to ISIS, it's pledged allegiance to ISIS, it is sort of its own organization. So there's another question there, right? So it's like, well, is it just this sort of particular offshoot or branch of ISIS that has, you know, this capacity to launch an attack of this scale? Or is it indicative broadly of ISIS in the region or even globally being more of an enduring force than was previously thought?
I think one of the things that really shook people today, no pun intended, was the fact that this was a brazen attack on civilians. This was an attack on a vegetable market. It was not an attack on an army installation or on a government building in any way. The bomber was on a motorcycle and he had the bomb strapped to his body. He went to the vegetable market and just plowed into the biggest crowd he could find and then detonated the bomb. Something like 50 people were killed in the bombing itself. But once the bomb went off, other ISIS fighters came out of their hiding places and began firing again at civilians. So we're talking about women, children, the elderly, whoever just happened to be walking down the street. Do you think we're going to see more attacks like this as ISIS is pushed farther and farther out of their strongholds?
Yeah, it's such a terrible attack. I think that, well, it's clear that the Syrian government and allied forces are winning like the territorial war in Syria, right? They've been taking back consistently for the past, you know, more than a year. The momentum has very clearly been on their side. They've been taking over, you know, they took back Aleppo, which was, you know, the most important city controlled by the opposition. They were able to clear out the areas in the east of the country up to the Euphrates River, which is controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish-dominated armed group that's backed by the United States. And now they've turned their attention to the southwest. And so, you know, as the Syrian government begins to sort of reassert its control over at least the vast majority of the territory east of the west of the Euphrates River, you know, the stuff that's outside of the control of the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the opposition needs to turn to other tactics, right? And, you know, there's I think this sort of fake dichotomy in the Western corporate media where, you know, there's the good, there's the rebels and then there's ISIS, right? And ISIS is considered this aberration that has nothing to do with the rest of the armed opposition. I don't think that's true. I think it pretty organically comes from the like extreme conservative religious trend that, you know, most of the other groups doing the fighting in Syria come from as well. The opposition groups, ISIS included, need to turn to other tactics. And for groups like ISIS, the most brutal, the most, you know, cruel, and the most willing to target civilians could just carry out these sort of spectacular terrorist attacks as a way to prevent the government from consolidating its rule over the territories that have been recaptured by the army.
You know, just as a policy matter, I have to agree with you that it doesn't really matter whose gun the bullet comes from if the bullet kills you. Whether it's ISIS, which I agree is on the extreme religious right, or it's one of the CIA-sponsored groups. A rebel is a rebel is a rebel if that rebel is shooting at you and trying to kill you. I think it really doesn't matter. Another thing, too, on a personal note, many of us have been to Daraa. We've been to Soweto. I mean, I've been all over Syria. I can't even imagine that the people that I met and that I ate with and socialized with are the ones who are taking up arms against their neighbors. It just seems to me illogical, unbelievable, that these have to be outside groups. These have to be terrorists who were radicalized in the Iraq War. Well, I shouldn't even say terrorists in many of these cases, but people who were radicalized in the Iraq War and then went to Syria as the extension of the fight in Iraq. But we don't really know anymore, do we? It seems like it's every man for himself, especially now in the southwest of Syria.
There's certainly the increasing presence of, throughout you know, the war, there's been many fighters who traveled from other countries to Syria to take part in the war. And then we also see a phenomenon of states, right, neighboring states or, you know, regional powers or, you know, the United States, right, which is many thousands of miles away, but takes a very particular interest in the future of Syria. So yeah, I mean, foreign intervention for sure is a major part of the war and has been since its inception, I would say. You know, the other thing we haven't talked about yet is what happened in the Golan, too, because
that was my next question.
Yeah, right? Because as this fighting, you know, on the topic of outside intervention, you know, this fighting is taking place just a few kilometers away from the demilitarized zone that was set up in 1974. So to give some historical background, there was in the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, there was, you know, the Israel won. They were able to capture the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. That's how they, you know, the occupation, as it's called, began over the West Bank and Gaza. You know, the West Bank was taken from Jordan, Gaza, I believe, from Egypt as well. And then there was another piece of territory that was taken by Israel during the 1967 war, and that was the Golan. Oftentimes it's referred to as the Golan Heights, but I actually think that's sort of like an Israeli propaganda term, because calling it the Golan Heights makes it seem like, oh, this is just like a really strategic and tiny position, and if poor defenseless Israel doesn't have control over these heights, then its enemies will be able to tower over it. And
that's what they used to argue. They used to argue that the Syrians were up at the top of the heights,
yeah,
and just lobbing bombs down on the settlers down below.
Yeah, yeah. So the Golan is not just like a big hill, right? The Golan is like
a region
of Syria.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So the Golan has been occupied since 1967. There was another big Arab-Israeli war in 1973, and following that in 1974, there was sort of, you know, not like a definitive resolution at all to the situation, but you know, sort of a status quo established where there'd be some United Nations presence in the area, there'd be a demilitarized zone. And so all of this fighting is taking place near this extremely politically sensitive piece of territory. And so what happened earlier today was that it appears that somebody just shot a rocket or a piece of artillery or something just a little bit further than they anticipated. And it ended up going into or close enough to Israeli territory that the Israeli military, the Israeli civil authorities issued, you know, the red alert sirens where, you know, they're blaring out in public. Everybody goes into shelters. And so it was a pretty politically dramatic moment, at least for a couple hours, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. You know, Israel just shot down a Syrian military jet that was carrying out operations targeting ISIS and ISIS-affiliated forces in that area. So, you know, it was a very, like, high-tension tinderbox situation. It appears to have calmed down for now, but of course the fighting is still going on. The political tensions are certainly still there, and we'll have to see if there's further escalation along the Golan.
Okay, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst, and he is one of the two producers of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Maria Butina, the Russian graduate student being accused of failing to register as an agent of a foreign government, appeared in court in Washington today to schedule a trial date and to have associated hearings. We're joined here in the studio by Alex Rubenstein. He's a Sputnik News analyst and journalist. You can find his work on Twitter at RealAlexRuby, R-U-B-I. Alex attended today's hearing. Alex, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Alex, you were there in the courtroom today. A lot went on. Tell us how things played out.
So mostly what happened today was arguments over discovery, the issue of how the defense obtains evidence from the government who is prosecuting the case. And the government has been objecting to the defense's statements to the media revolving, and they were fearful that the defense may use evidence obtained in discovery to rebut claims in the media.
You know what? That's got to be funny because this woman is being convicted
in the media. Exactly.
It's in the media. So now they're saying to the defense attorney, "Oh, we can't let you know why we're really prosecuting her on the basis of what evidence, because you might say something to the media that would influence public opinion."
Right, which is exactly what they're doing and what they have been doing since the very beginning of this case.
Well, I mean, they are letting him know, but they're seeking to gag him on that. So I mean, they're trying to get protective orders to make certain pieces of evidence a no-go for discussion. You know, the defense noted last night CNN published a report claiming that Maria Butina received training as a spy in Russia, which is not something that the government alleges. And so he says, you know, this is stuff that I have to push back on because it influences the public is the argument. And even the judge noted that D.C. has a very limited jury pool. And I mean, I think both of you know that D.C. is not particularly favorable to Russia,
to put it mildly at the moment. So, yeah, so they're trying to gag the defense. At the same time, drip, 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 they let out little either evidence or inferences to the media so that she's a Russian spy. I mean, there's even like they're citing the fact, Alex, that she's getting her instructions and her orders from a Russian official. That's if you read the mainstream media, the corporate owned media, certainly the print journalism, you would say, she even said, "I'm awaiting my orders from so-and-so, a Russian official." Obviously, that means she's part of a chain of command. She's a spy. That's what the suggestion is.
Right. They would say that she was caught red-handed there. But if you look a little bit closer at the substance of the evidence in the FBI affidavit, that "I'm awaiting orders" comment that came right after the election was probably made in jest, I would think, because it was sent over a Twitter direct message to Alexander Torshin, an official at a Russian bank who was her mentor. And John, I mean, you were with the CIA.
Yeah. Listen, spy-to-spy communications are not done over Twitter. I can guarantee you that. This was either a joke or it was taken completely out of context. And let me come back to your previous point, too, about leaks, whether they're coming from the prosecution or from the defense. And obviously, they're coming from the prosecution. There's a way to stop that. And it's called a SIPA hearing. It stands for Classified Information Protection Act hearing. So all that the judge has to do is declare this a SIPA case, and they will seal the courtroom. Everybody's expelled from the courtroom. And then there's a criminal penalty if anybody leaks anything to the press. That's all she has to do. But she hasn't done that. And so you're right. Robert Driscoll, Butina's attorney, is going to have to continue to push back on these false allegations that are being spread to the mainstream media.
Right. And another one of those, for example, is the allegation that Butina traded sex for a position at a special interest company. And Driscoll said today, you know, "We don't believe that. We've been shown no evidence." He's repeatedly asked the government for that evidence and they've denied it. And that's the big issue in Driscoll's words that the mainstream media has like latched onto because it's like it's sexy. It's like scandalous, you know.
And it's misogynist. You never hear men being accused of trading sex information.
That's a good point.
It's 100% directed towards caricaturing, stereotyping, and vilifying women.
And Slavs.
Yeah. I want to go back to the essence of the allegation. This woman was functioning openly. She's been functioning openly for a long time as a gun rights enthusiast. Her so-called mentor, Torshin, also an enthusiast and a promoter of guns in Russia. Now, that's a big issue in Russia because Russia doesn't have a Second Amendment. Maria Butina comes from Siberia. There is a lot of gun use in Siberia. She's been a gun enthusiast for years. Now they're all trying to make it look like that must be just a cover for a Russian spy agent. There was an article written by Julia Yaffe in the New Republic in 2012 that quotes Maria Butina. And the title is The Rise of Russia's Gun Nuts. In other words, people who are fixated on guns. And it goes over why in Russia this is considered to be a bad idea for everybody to have weapons. And yet there is a lobby, including Maria Butina and her mentor, Torshin, to actually promote having a sort of a liberal policy whereby everybody, like in the United States, can own a gun. The article is also interesting because it also makes it clear that she's actually not a friend of Vladimir Putin.
No, in fact, she is well known as an opponent of Vladimir Putin.
And she has the endorsement of Navalny, who is recognized as Putin's main political opponent.
And she participated in protests against Putin's party in, I think, 2012 in a square in Moscow after his party overwhelmingly won the Duma.
Yeah. So again, she is being convicted in the media.
Without a doubt.
So now the defense is asking for discovery to understand the basis of this complaint. And now the prosecution is saying, well, if they get hold of that information, they're going to try to tamper with the jury pool by influencing public opinion, which apparently is only the exclusive right of the prosecution. I mean, just think about how she got arrested and why she got arrested. I mean, even that, when you look at the arresting complaint, it's quite remarkable.
Right. She was arrested because the FBI feared that they wouldn't be able to surveil her because she was fleeing. And then where was she going? She was going in a rented U-Haul truck with her boyfriend to go move to South Dakota, where I can't imagine what kind of spying activity could be conducted in South Dakota for Russia.
What about the FBI can't carry out surveillance in South Dakota?
Right.
Apparently, I mean,
maybe
they did
she
it in
was
North
going
Dakota.
To Russia. No, she was taking the U-Haul and she was fleeing Russia. Because it's easy to get to Russia vis-a-vis a U-Haul.
As we all know.
It's so ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
The judge's concessions on this issue of discovery were like really not generous to the defense at all. For example, before Butina was arrested, before her house was raided with FBI agents with guns drawn, she was interviewed by the Senate Intelligence Committee for 8 hours behind closed
voluntarily.
Doors.
Voluntarily.
Voluntarily. And so the defense is trying to get their hands on that testimony. They can't because of constitutional reasons. The government has reviewed it, but says that they don't have it. And so what does the judge say today? She says, oh, well, you know, they can deliver that discovery to you orally or at least the substance of it orally. You're going to get the substance of 8 hours of testimony delivered orally several months after the fact? It's very doubtful.
And again, where does it all end up? I mean, this woman, John, was testifying, as you said, voluntarily before the Mueller probe, right?
Yes.
And Mueller, at the end of the day, after she voluntarily testified, he said, we don't have any interest in her.
That's right.
And then the arrest happened on what day?
As Donald Trump was getting ready to meet with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki.
So at the very moment that Trump is trying to overcome the sort of very bad press about him meeting with Putin, at that moment, the arrest comes. She's arrested because guess what? She was going to get in a U-Haul truck and flee.
Well, let me say something
about
that.
And so it had to happen right then and there because she was going to flee.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Now, this is clearly meant for two reasons. Number one, the obvious one is to embarrass Donald Trump. Okay, that's fine. I understand there's a feud going on right now. One side hits the other, then the other retaliates. That's Washington. The other thing is, and I said this on Eugene Puryear's show a couple of hours ago, that this is how these people get promoted, right? If you're an FBI agent, if you're an assistant U.S. attorney, and there are hundreds of them, this is how you get promoted, by picking the low-hanging fruit, concocting a case against somebody, and convicting them. And the way you convict them is you charge them with a whole bunch of felonies, and then you come back later once they go broke and you offer them a deal. They always take the deal. And that's why the government wins 98.2% of its cases, according to ProPublica. Higher up the food chain, U.S. attorneys. Every U.S. attorney wants to be governor or wants to be a congressman. And I can name, like I said on Eugene's show, I can name a dozen of them right now who either are governors or are congressmen. So this is Washington, that you promote yourself, you get ahead in life by walking on the backs of people like Maria Butina.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the low-hanging fruit. I mean, this is a woman who's a public figure in Russia, has had a ton of media coverage in the United States, and I read a report today that while she attended American University, she was like very vocal about her views, her nationalist views.
I read that in the Post today.
Exactly. Yeah, and so you're absolutely right. It's low-hanging fruit, and the timing of that with that fact really makes for a very suspicious trial, for a very suspicious prosecution, I should say, that looks political. It stinks of politics.
It really does.
Yeah, and of course, the Russian government is making the argument the U.S. government is trying to just break her, whatever that means, because if she doesn't really have access, well, she has an attorney. She has a good attorney.
One. Yeah, Driscoll's good.
But if she's facing a ton of charges and she's in another country and she's going to go to jail for 10, 15 years, the likelihood is, this is what the government's planning on, you'll plead to a lesser charge. Because, of course, 98% of the people in jail never had a trial. Or if they had a trial, well, 94% never had a trial because they're afraid to go to trial because the government always wins at the trial.
That's right.
So, yeah, so she'll plead guilty. And then the prosecution can say, see, we were right. She pled guilty.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you have hundreds, if not thousands of people, at least in the federal system, who proclaim their innocence. Right. There's no parole in the federal system. You do the whole stretch. They proclaim their innocence. Well, until I went into the prison system, I just figured, well, every criminal says he's innocent. But there are a lot of innocent people in prison for exactly the reason that Brian told us. It's because it's so expensive to defend yourself, and you have to defend yourself against so many different charges.
And the dangers that you face when you lose are so great. Anyway.
They're great. We're out of time.
We're out of time.
We were joined here in the studio by Alex Rubenstein. He is a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter at RealAlexRuby, R-U-B-I. Check it out, because he live tweeted the hearing today, and it was fascinating. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The European Union is preparing to impose $20 billion in new tariffs on American cars in response to President Trump's tariffs on European goods 2 weeks ago. The EU's trade chief said in advance of a meeting with Trump that the EU does not want a trade war, but would match U.S. tariffs dollar for dollar. Meanwhile, Trump said that he was willing to provide Midwestern farmers hit by the EU tariffs with $12 billion in cash assistance. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. And he's also the author of an article in the World Review of Political Economy entitled Trump's Deja Vu China Trade War. Dr. Rasmus, welcome back.
My pleasure.
I want to read to you two of Donald Trump's tweets. These both came this morning around 8 o'clock Eastern time. He said first this: the European Union is coming to Washington tomorrow to negotiate a deal on trade. I have an idea for them. Both the U.S. and the EU drop all tariffs, barriers, and subsidies. That would finally be called free market and free trade. I hope they do. We are ready, but they won't. That was the first tweet. The second says, tariffs are the greatest! Exclamation point. Either a country which has treated the United States unfairly on trade negotiates a fair deal or gets hit with tariffs. It's as simple as that. And everybody's talking. Remember, we are the piggy bank that's being robbed. All will be great! Exclamation point. What do you make of these? They seem to be diametrically opposed to one another. What does Donald Trump really want? What's his economic policy here?
Well, it's not as simple as that, as he claims. Okay. It's a very complex situation, in fact. Are we in a trade war? Well, you got to distinguish between political threats, tweets about imposing tariffs, from actual announcement of tariffs, from actual implementation of tariffs. If you look at where we are right now, the total amount of tariffs the U.S. has imposed is only 2.3% of the U.S.'s $3 trillion worth of imports. And the others have, the trade adversaries have imposed a similar 2.3%. So we're not in a trade war yet, but we're coming real close. A trade war means not just tariffs, you see. It's a tariff fight, might be a tariff war, but a trade war uses all of the kinds of instruments. I'm referring specifically to currency devaluations. Once the tariff war precipitates into a currency war, and we're coming darn close to that, then you got a real trade war. And currency devaluations, competitive currency devaluations, can easily offset the tariffs, and they reverberate throughout the global economy. China right now has allowed its currency to drift towards the one end of the band in which its currency, the yuan, fluctuates to the dollar. And if it devalues any further, that will send a signal to other countries to devalue as well. And now you've got a full-blown currency war, and it doesn't matter what tariffs you've imposed, because now it's far more serious. And we're getting close to that. That's why you see business interests coming forth and sending shots across the bow to Trump. Wait a minute, you know, you're going too far. Trump says this will be resolved shortly. If you look at China, China imposed a tit-for-tat $34 billion of tariffs on the U.S. aimed at U.S. agricultural goods, and now they're starting to bite. This $12 billion subsidy he's proposing, Trump, is to offset some of the losses to date, not even talking about future losses. And people should keep in mind that this $12 billion of subsidy to U.S. farmers, which is really agribusiness, right? This $12 billion comes out of the Agricultural Department. The Agricultural Department is also the department that issues food stamps. I see this as a potential ploy to justify cutting food stamps by $12 billion. You'll see that that will be forthcoming. So he's going to get two bites out of the apple here, and he's going to shift the money from people who need food to agribusiness subsidies. But the point is, the agribusiness subsidies, this $12 billion doesn't even begin to touch the full losses that agribusiness is going to experience in the months ahead. It doesn't even cover the losses to date.
Jack, much has been made in the past couple of days about these apparent cash subsidies to farmers in the Midwest. You know, at first glance, this just seems like a brazen attempt to buy the political loyalty of farmers who, frankly, were instrumental in getting Donald Trump elected president in the first place. I also had the thought that it kind of smacks of socialism, doesn't it? That you take money from one group and then you give it to another group. That's exactly what the Republicans have been campaigning against. But how long can something like this last? Is this tenable, where you can impose tariffs and sanctions on our biggest, most important trading partners, damage the trade relationship, and then just make up for it by spreading around cash to the people who voted for you? Is that a realistic trade policy?
I wouldn't call it social. I'd call it big agribusiness corporate welfare.
That's really what it is.
That's really what it is. And it's shifting the money around. And as I said briefly a minute ago, you're either going to have to take it out of food stamps, they're going to try to do that, or you're going to have to exacerbate the budget deficit even further. China very cleverly threw out some big concessions to U.S. banks and to the agribusiness sector of the U.S. economy, and then it's set back, and it's not negotiating. It's letting it bite. It's letting the tariffs, the tit-for-tat Chinese tariffs, you know, that match $34 billion, mm-hmm. matched Trump's tariffs on them. It's letting it bite on the soybeans and the pork and the cotton and the wheat farmers and the corn farmers. And that's why they're not coming to the negotiating table. They're letting it bite a little bit. And Trump's response has been twofold. One is this $12 billion subsidy. And what are they going to do? Keep upping that billions of dollars subsidies if the Chinese don't negotiate? You know, that's going to exacerbate the budget deficit. And then you got Trump coming along and saying, oh, the Chinese are manipulating their currency, allowing it to devaluate right within a band. Well, you know, that's really ironic, because the Chinese currency is slowly devaluing because the U.S. dollar is rapidly appreciating. If the dollar appreciates, the yuan will devalue. So Trump is causing the devaluations. Well, why are U.S. interest rates, why is the dollar rising? Because U.S. interest rates are rising. Why are U.S. interest rates rising? For the Federal Reserve to finance Trump's trillion-dollar annual deficits. Why do we have annual deficits? $5 trillion Trump tax cuts. So Trump is causing the devaluation of the Chinese yuan, and yet he comes across saying, oh, you're manipulating your currency.
Donald Trump likes to think and likes to tell people that he is the great deal maker. What kind of a deal would allow him to claim success? And do you think that such a deal would be possible?
Well, you have to say a deal with whom, okay? The deal is very close with Mexico. It was close earlier this spring. The only two issues that are keeping a deal apart with Mexico is the U.S. insisting that American companies in Mexico cannot be sued, and secondly, that any deal with Mexico has a five-year limit to it. Well, those provisions can be removed very quickly, and I suspect that Trump will do that very quickly with Mexico. Might even be before the election, certainly soon after the election. Now, you're not going to get a deal with Europe very soon. That's because Europe has to clean up its Brexit situation. Although Juncker, the president of the European Union, is in Washington today, and he's proposing some kind of free trade, multilateral free trade with automobiles, and maybe talking about industrial products only. Those are the EU's two provisions or offers here. I don't think there's going to be a deal there very soon. There's no deal with China because the U.S. Is insisting on technology transfer. China will open its markets. China will increase its imports from the U.S., but China will not give up its technology transfer programs because it sees that as the key to the future. China is now digging in economically. It increased its money supply from the central bank, and it's engaging in more investment, government investment, to offset any losses from a trade war with the U.S. So China is digging in. He's not going to get a deal. He's telling people he's going to get a deal real quick.
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to get a deal real quick, Donald.
And you remember he said winning a trade war is easy. He said before this whole thing started that he was going to launch this trade war and winning it would be easy. And now here we are. Just the beginning of being mired in this problem, not just with the Chinese, but with the EU, the Canadians, and the Mexicans as well. Give us your final thoughts. We have 30 seconds left.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy, especially if this thing trips over into a currency war. Then he's lost control of it all, you see. And then it's competitive devaluations across the board, especially in countries like Turkey and Argentina and so forth that are already in deep, deep recessions. And, of course, Japan's in recession, and Europe is beginning to stagnate once again. So this thing is not going to be ended quickly. And as quickly as he thinks, he's very naive economically. He sees things very simplistically. All I have to do is intimidate someone, bang him on the head, and they're going to agree to my deal. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. And Donald is going to find himself mired in a trade situation, a true trade war, as the economy in the U.S. softens in 2019.
That was the voice of Dr. Jack Rasmus. He joined us from California. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy, and the Coming Depression. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.